All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our sixth and final lesson of Curious Tales of the Talmud. It's always bittersweet for me when we arrive at the sixth lesson. It's an exciting lesson at the same time, in the back of my mind, it's like, this is it? I'm going to miss our gatherings together. But we have other opportunities. I'll speak about them as we conclude the class this evening. But let's talk about the class tonight. So the story we're going to be focusing on, as Curious Tales of the Talmud is dealing with, of course, the Curious Tales of the Talmud, those bizarre, strange, perplexing stories that beg for some additional interpretation. So, the story we're going to be focusing on tonight takes place in one of the most difficult times in Jewish history. And the story that we're about to read frighteningly foretells of one of the most heart-wrenching accounts in Jewish history. And what I'm referring to is the martyr's death of one Rabbi Hanina ben Trajan. He was one of the 10 martyrs that we read about on Yom Kippur and on Tisha B'Av. It's an account that rips out. It's a very emotional account. And the story that we're about to read is what happens right before he's captured and put to death, as we'll see. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be presenting a very strange story that takes place between two rabbis, with one of them on their deathbed. And the story speaks to what it means to live a virtuous life from a Jewish perspective. What does it mean to live a good life from a Jewish perspective? And in the process of the story, of the questions that are asked and the answers that's given, the process of the story, we're going to be learning important life lessons related to personal growth, change, and character development. So the lesson, the title of the lesson is A Ticket to Paradise, Exceeding Limitations and Pursuing Growth. So that's the topic. We're going to get to it through the gateway of this curious tale of the Talmud. And as we do every week, we're going to talk about the story, we're going to rip it apart with many questions, and then we'll reconstruct it. We'll put it back together again in a way that's completely novel and fresh and that shares the insights that we're getting after. So let's begin. Before we mention the story, let me give you the historical context. I mentioned a moment ago, very briefly, that it takes place in one of the darkest moments, one of the darkest eras of Jewish history. Well, what was going on then? What era are we talking about? It was in the second century. It was in the second century. We're talking a time that was several decades after the story that we read about last week, which is the story of the debate between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Remember, they debated about the oven? So this is talking about several decades. That happened at the end of the first century. So this is several decades later. And it's also several years after the great debate between Rabbi Yeshua and the elders of Athens that we studied 2 weeks ago. So it's after both. And as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, the emperor, the Roman emperor at the time, was a fellow named Hadrian. The Talmud is referred to as Adrianus. But his name is Hadrian, recorded in history. At least that's how Wikipedia has it, so that's certainly the authority. So, Emperor Hadrian. He begins his rule in the year 119, and his rule concludes, he passes away in the year 138 of our common era. As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, he begins his rule as a friend to the Jews. In fact, the story is recorded in the Talmud that he promised the Jews that he would allow them to rebuild the temple. Somewhere along the way, his heart completely changes and he does a 180. And not only is he not friendly to the Jews, but he is antagonistic, more than antagonistic. He is hateful. He is trying to crush and destroy the Jewish people. Some tie it in historically to the Jewish revolt that was occurring at the time, the Bar Kokhba revolt, where this Jewish leader in general was trying to take back the political autonomy from Rome. And the Romans had to come in and crush, they had to, they did, they came in and crushed the revolt, the city of Beitar, etc. So some attribute it to the Jewish uprising as far as what changed his mind. Others say he on his own changed his mind. But either way, the Talmud records that he became a cruel and vicious hater of the Jewish people. And he enacted many decrees to humiliate and also to crush the Jewish spirit. And his mind wished to destroy Judaism, God forbid. Some of the decrees that he enacted, some of the things that he banned, Jewish practices that he banned, amongst them were circumcision, bris milah, observing Shabbos, eating matzah on Passover, building a sukkah on Sukkot, wrapping tefillin, reciting the Shema, going to the mikvah, observing Hanukkah, and rabbinic ordination known as smicha. The question is, what's left? He went after the essentials. And of course, the big one, I mean, these are all big, but a big one that he didn't mention in this list. So here we have circumcision, Shabbos, matzah, sukkah, tefillin, shema, family purity, mikvah, Hanukkah candles, huh? Pretty much. The big one that's relevant to our story that we're about to read is the ban on Torah study and teaching Torah. So there was a ban, a wholesale ban. Not only are you're not allowed to teach Torah, you're not allowed to study Torah, Torah is banned. And the punishment for violating these edicts were torture or death or both. And the people, the Jews then, were living in this amidst this terror and fear. They were living under this tyrant who had put on these very cruel decrees. So it's under this dark shadow that our story takes place, the main story of tonight's class, which we'll focus on. Text 1, Ezra, take it away, 2:14. You have a question? Okay, 2:14, text 1.
Rabbi Hanina ben Tiradian?
Yeah.
Paid a visit to Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, who had fallen when he was lying on his deathbed. Rabbi Yossi said to Rabbi Hanina, "Hanina, my brother, do you not know that by heavenly decree the Romans rule the land? They have destroyed God's house for his sanctuary, killed his pious ones, and wiped out his noble ones. His most noble ones. And the regime is still at the height of power. Yet I hear that you still study Torah, and furthermore, you convene public gatherings in which you flout the regime and teach Torah to the masses with the Torah scroll sitting in your lap. Heaven will have mercy upon you, Rabbi Hanina replied. I'm telling you something sensible, Rabbi Yossi pleaded, and you replied that heaven will have mercy. Why, I would be amazed if the Romans did not burn you together with the Torah scroll. Rabbi Hanina then asked, Master, how do I stand with regard to the world to come? Have you performed any worthy deeds? I once inadvertently switched money purses and distributed charity from the purse that I had designated for my poor meal instead of the charity purse. I did not then seek reimbursement from the charity purse. Rather, I dispersed its contents to charity too. If that is indeed so, Rabbi Yossi exclaimed, may your portion be my portion. May your lot be my lot.
And that's how the story ends. Yeah. My lot should be, yeah. I want your lot and your fate, etc. Okay, so this is where the story ends in our textbooks. However, it doesn't end here in the Talmud. The Talmud continues. I'll tell you what it says. Talmud continues to share what happens next. A few days later, the Talmud says, Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma passes away. The fellow that was on his deathbed, Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma. And the Roman noblemen, authorities, etc., high figures, are going to the funeral. On the way back, they find Rabbi Hanina ben Tragian, Rabbi Hanina of our story. They find him sitting and teaching Torah in public. They arrest him. And the Talmud says what happens next. They arrested him, they took him, they wrapped him in a Torah scroll, they put some twigs around him, and they burned him alive in the Torah scroll. It also says in the Talmud that they took wool, wet it in water, and put it over his heart, so that the flames would not reach his heart quickly, so that his suffering would be prolonged. So the Talmud gets into very graphic detail about his suffering and the brutal torture that they put him through before his passing, before they killed him. We read about it again, as I mentioned before, on Yom Kippur, in the account of the 10 martyrs. He's one of the 10 martyrs that we read about on Yom Kippur and also on Tisha B'Av. And on these days, it certainly evokes tears, and even when we read about it, when we hear about it in any setting, It evokes, it truly pains the heart. And when his students, the Talmud says, when his students asked him while he was being burned alive, they asked him, "Master, what do you see?" He said as follows, "The parchment is burning, but the letters are soaring on high." This is what he said. He said that although the parchment of the Torah scroll is burning, but the letters he saw were soaring on high. And with these words, Rabbi Hanina captured really the essence of what has kept the Jewish people alive throughout the millennia, throughout all hardship, throughout all horrific experiences and persecution and Holocaust and Inquisitions and Crusades, etc. And that is the spirit of Judaism, which is the Torah, the Jewish soul, etc. The spirit can never be destroyed. Although you can destroy the body, the parchment might be burning, but the letters are soaring on high. The spirit of the Jew can never be broken, can never be destroyed. And how that's how the story of the Talmud ends. That's how the account ends. And how frightening, though, is that when we read this story, that's kind of the prelude to it, where Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma on his deathbed is saying, "Why I would be amazed if the Romans do not burn you together with the Torah scroll." How what type of foreshadowing and foretelling Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma had there right on his deathbed. But all of that is the end of the story, and we're not really going to focus on tonight's class is not focusing on the end of the story. I wanted to share it with you just so that you know. You have the complete picture, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with the story of the 10 martyrs, and even if not the specifically the story of Rabbi Hanina, but he is one of the 10 martyrs, and again, he was the one who was burned alive, wrapped in the Torah scroll. The part of the story that we're going to focus on, though, is the part of the story that we have in our text. And I'm going to turn the tables on you and ask you, what parts of this story that we read inside, that Ezra read inside, what parts of this story are perplexing to you? Any questions on the story?
What was the relationship between Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Yosef?
It seems like they were colleagues.
Because the question that came to mind is, why was he asking him what his lot was in the...
Okay. Good, 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 good. It seems like Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma was a colleague, and yet Rabbi Hanina certainly visited him on the deathbed, asked him questions, and so maybe he was somewhat of an elder sage, so he was consulting with him. But I like where you're going with the question. You know, before we get there, let's just discuss for a brief moment the first half of the story. In the first half of the story, it's interesting, we have really a debate, an ideological debate as far as what should be done when there are decrees against Judaism and against Torah. Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma says, so take Torah and go underground. Right? He says, go underground. Don't flout the regime, the Roman regime in public. And Rabbi Hanina says, no, we're not changing a thing. I'm going to study Torah in public. I'm going to teach Torah in public. And whatever Hashem wants will happen. We can debate which approach is right, which approach has worked historically. But we see here clearly this ideological debate between these two great sages. But the second half of the story, as Burton mentioned, is really the more perplexing part of the tale. I have five questions. Anybody have a question? Mike, you have a question? No? Any questions? I got five of them. Should I just tell you my questions? Okay.
Question? Why did you change the money?
Oh, and the actual story about the Purim thing. By the way, did everyone catch what happened with the monies? The money purses. So he had one money purse of his own money. Like, you know, Rabbi Hanina's wallet. Bag o' cash. And then he had another charity bag o' cash that was meant to be distributed to the poor. In fact, the Talmud says that he was the tzedakah distributor for that community. And it's only given to the most trustworthy person that's totally, you know, above any type of question about their integrity, etc. Rabbi Hanina was that person. So he was beyond reproach, beyond any shadow of a doubt. His honesty was unsurpassed. So he was given the task of being entrusted with his money purse. What happens is, he gives the tzedakah, he gives the charity from his own money. Somehow he gave to the poor from his own money bag. He realizes it later, so he needs money for his own meal. So should he take the money? Should he just consider it swapped out? No. He says, listen, I gave tzedakah from my money. The other money is still designated for tzedakah. I'm going to give that also again to charity. I'm not going to switch it. And I'll figure out my own, I'll get some more money for myself somehow for my own meal. So your question is, why did he do that? Why did he do that? Because, again, that money purse that was designated for tzedakah, he felt that if he starts playing a game of, well, okay, well, I spent it there, but let me reimburse myself there, it's already getting into some gray territory. Not that it's really gray, but it could be gray. Why could it be gray? Because once you start dipping into the charity, into that which is designated for tzedakah, and putting it in your own pocket, even though because you gave from your own pocket to tzedakah, whatever that is, whatever happened before, bottom line is you're taking out of the tzedakah bag for yourself, for your own meal, he felt that just doesn't feel right. It's not right. So therefore he said, I'll make my own plan, etc. So to me, that's not one of my five questions. I'll tell you what my five questions. Yeah, go.
I was struck that
perfect.
To get him into the world to come, that he had to
perfect
tell this other story of something he had to get him in. And here he is repeating that by teaching Torah.
I love it.
And that's not good enough.
I love it. That question, that central question, is actually takes on different forms of my questions. That's like what drives two or three of my questions. Number one, question number one is, why is Rabbi Hanina concerned about his standing with regard to the world to come? Master, how do I stand with regard to the world to come? Why is he concerned? We just got through talking about how he studies Torah in public, he teaches Torah in public, defying the Romans, living with self-sacrifice and trust in God. So why is he questioning his place in the world to come? Question number one. Question number two, it's again along these same lines. What's Rabbi Yossi's response? Have you performed any worthy deeds? What kind of response is that? Why didn't he cut him off and say, what kind of question are you asking? In other words, he should have questioned the question and say, you're asking me if you have a place in the world to come? Of course you do. We just talked about how you're teaching Torah in public, defying the Roman decree, keeping Torah alive, endangering your own life. What kind of question are you asking? Instead, he hears the question. He says, you know what? It's a good question. And now he asks, Noob, do you have any worthy deeds to get you in? What do you mean, do you have any worthy deeds? What about the Torah that he's teaching? What about the Torah that he's studying in public? Right? It's all the same type of question, but the dialogue doesn't make sense. And then he finally answers. Bechina says, you know, I found once, there was a story with a money person, Purim. Why is that his ticket into paradise?
Why is that more significant than what he was doing?
Then Torah, why is that more? What, and he never honored his parents, and he never... I'm sure he did many mitzvot. So he happened to pull out this one from his memory. Oh, you know, it once happened that there was a money purse. This is the one that stands out for him. This is the one that's going to get him into the world to come. Doesn't make sense. Ticket to Paradise is the title of the class. What's his ticket to paradise? Because one time when he switched money purses, he didn't reimburse himself from the charity purse. He said, fine, we'll give twice. Okay. Not discount this. It's not a mitzvah. But that's it. That's the one that's greater than his self-sacrifice to teach Torah. I mean, and that's greater than all the other mitzvot that he surely did throughout his life.
Well, you have the same. Why did Rabbi Yossi put such strength in it that he would benefit if that had happened to him?
And that's the fifth question: is why the response of Rabbi Yossi? If that's so, you didn't tell me about the money bag. Yeah, the money bag. Oh, if that's so, may your portion be my portion, may your lot be my lot, i.e., I'm jealous of you. I wish that was me. Oh, you want the tzedakah story with the money, with the Purim and the money bags. Oh, I wish that was me. What's so significant about that, story? What's insignificant, seemingly insignificant about his putting his own life on the line? So many questions. Again, we've distilled it into five questions, but the bottom line is, we're struggling to figure out exactly what was going on in this dialogue. So in order to understand one more thing. Before we move toward an answer, let's read one more story. Another perplexing tale. Another curious tale of the Talmud. It's similar, very similar sentiment. It occurs with a different sage, one who we should be very familiar with, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Remember who Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was? He was the fellow who smuggled himself out of Jerusalem, out of the walls of Jerusalem, in order to save Judaism and Torah scholarship in the city of Yavne. So this story happens years later, when Rabbi Yochanan is on his deathbed. So this is what happens. Sandy, will you read? You up for it?
I'll try.
Okay, text number two. If you can.
I might not pronounce everything perfectly.
Not a problem. Not a problem. I'll help you out. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai.
Okay, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai fell ill, his disciples went to visit him. When he saw them, he began to weep. His disciples said to him, "Lamp of Israel, pillar of the right hand, mighty hammer, why do you weep?" Rabbi Yochanan replied, "I were being taken today before a human king who is here today and tomorrow in the grave, whose anger, if he is angry with me, does not last forever, who, if he imprisons me, does not imprison me forever, and who, if he puts me to death, does not put me to everlasting death, and whom I can persuade with words and bribe with money, even so I would weep. Now I'm being taken before the Supreme King of Kings, the Holy One. Blessed be He who lives and endures forever and ever, whose anger, if He is angry with me, is an everlasting anger, who, if He imprisons me forever, who, if He puts me to death forever, and whom I cannot persuade with words or bribe with money. Moreover, there are two paths before me, one leading to paradise, and the other to
Gehinnom,
and I do not know on which I shall be taken. Shall I not then weep?"
And Gehinnom is, of course, purgatory. So he says, "Shall I not weep? I don't know where I'm going. There's two paths before me." Right? Sheyesh lefanai shnei derachim. There are two paths before me. I don't know where they're going to take me. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai on his deathbed is crying because he doesn't know where they're going to take him. What does that say for us? Ay vey. Ach and vey, as they say in Yiddish. Uh-oh. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai doesn't know. He's frightened. Am I going to go to paradise? Am I going to go to Gehinnom, God forbid? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, saved Judaism, saved Torah. Started the academy in Yavne. The Torah that we have today is only because, I mean, God could have figured out a plan certainly, but on the ground, the way history plays out is because of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. That's why we have Torah today. He doesn't know where he's going to end up. Well, yeah, but how not self-aware can a person be? Is it misplaced humility? Is it delusion? I mean, what's going on here? It's similar to Rabbi Hanina, who's this Torah scholar putting his life in the line, and he's saying, "Rabbi Yossi, do I have a ticket to the world to come?" And he's like, "Oh, maybe. If you could tell me a good story about a Purim money basket." Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't appear to serve any purpose.
Which part?
The part making the comparison
between God and the human being. Basically, he's saying that a human being, I would be scared to not know what the human king is going to, if I'm taken before a human king to pronounce judgment upon me, would we not be afraid? We don't have kings today. But if there was a king who had in his power life and death, and we were arrested, God forbid, and taken in front of the king, will we not shake? We would shake. And he's saying, if I would shake and cry and be fearful and not be able to sleep, etc., the night before I'm taken to a human king, I should be able to be relaxed and calm and secure when I stand before the heavenly king. And the human king already is nothing is forever. Whatever a human king says, at the end of the day, it's not forever. And a human king, you can appease with words and you can bribe with money. But the King of Kings, and by the way, the death that he's talking about is not death, where there's the afterlife. He's talking about if he puts me to death, God forbid, puts me to death forever, that would mean that there would be, that write that person, that write that soul off forever, theoretically. So Rabbi Yochanan is saying, for good reason I'm concerned. I don't know what the verdict's going to be. There are two paths. I don't know where I'm going to be taken. So our question is, are you kidding me? You don't know where you're going to be taken. I know. Yeah, it's paradise. Okay, so these are the questions. Similar story. These sages are concerned shortly before their passing. What's going to be the end? What's going to be the next stage? And our question is, why are they concerned when they have so many good things, so many good deeds, and so many great accomplishments under their belt? So to understand this, we're going to switch gears for a moment. Now, we're not really switching gears, but it's going to look like we're switching gears, only on the surface. But really, we're totally on target. We're going to switch gears for a moment and talk about the concept of personal growth and character development. So we all know how popular this field is. You know, you walk into any bookstore, apparently there are a few left. So you walk into a bookstore, into self-help, Amazon.com does not count as a bookstore. It's an online bookstore, but not a real... We love Amazon, I'm just saying. Anyway, so you walk into a bookstore, because you can't walk into Amazon. I remember when Borders... even then, until we get virtual reality, it's still going to be tricky. I remember seeing a picture of a Borders when Borders were going out of business and closing up, where they put on their one. I don't think it was locally, but I just saw it on the internet, where one Borders put up a sign in their window that said something like "No bathrooms available." Like go to Amazon.com or something if you want to. Like something like that. Like, if you want a bathroom, you can't come. Go to Amazon because they have everything, right? All right. Anyway, little bitter, huh? Get a cup of coffee. Which soon? Listen, this thing—you press a button, pumps out coffee. Pretty close. Pretty close. Soon we're going to be sending it messages. Anyway, let me not channel my inner Jetsons. Now let's get back here. So if you walk into the self-help section of a bookstore, so you'll find many, many titles. And if you look at the bestsellers, and many on Amazon and other places, lots of self-help. Seminars that deal with this topic of self-help. Magazines, blogs, TED Talks, wherever you look, it's all about self-help, personal growth, character development, etc., etc., etc. So it's not at all a stretch to say that everyone has things about themselves that they would like to change. And indeed, I think this line captures it. Even if you're on the right track, you'll get run over if you just sit there. Right? So we're always looking to grow. In general, people are always looking to grow and to develop, to change the things that they need to change, etc. So if you take a look at learning exercise number 1 on page 218. So here there's some questions. Let's spend just a few minutes. I'm going to give about like 2 or 3 minutes. This is a very a personal and private exercise. The main idea is for you to start thinking along these lines so that as we continue the discussion, it will become more real than if it's just abstract. I'm going to be speaking in abstract terms, but if you take a few minutes just to write down a few items on this list, then it will become real to you as we go through it. So the first question is, or the first item here in this learning exercise is, I would like to cease doing or do less of something. I would like to start doing or do more of something else. I would like to become more blank. I would like to become less blank. So take a few minutes, take 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and fill in some answers. We'll regroup in just a moment. Right, let's give another 30 seconds. This is quick change. Super fast. Okay, here's the key question, at least for me. A major question is the last one that I didn't read before. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 is unchallenging, 10 is very challenging. How challenging would it be to implement these changes in an enduring manner? Anybody want to throw out the number? I don't need the details. Just give me the number of how difficult it would be to really get these things on the list. 10. 10. 10. 10.
8.
8, okay. Good. We have an optimist. Okay, I think in my very unscientific Gallup poll, we have here a sampling that has the number on the higher end of the scale. And for good reason. Because we all know what happens when we make these resolutions. And we say, oh, we're going to change. And it's going to be a different year. And it's going to, oh, 2000 or whatever, 57, 70, whatever. Oh, it's going to be, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and the other. And before you know it, sometimes we slip back into old patterns. As they say, old habits die hard. Take a look at text 3. This was an interesting study that I found in this book. And I think it's relevant to our conversation. Text 3, Jan, please take it away.
The brain is always trying to automate things and to create habits, which then deals with feelings of pleasure. Holding to the tried and true gives us a feeling of security, safety, and confidence, while at the same time reducing our fear of the future and failure, writes brain researcher Gerhard Roth at the University of Bremen in Germany in his 2007 book, whose title translates as Personality, Decision, and Behavior. Personality traits change more during adulthood than any other period of life, according to psychologist Brent W. Roberts at the University of Illinois, who together with two colleagues analyzed 92 studies of personality development. They concluded that some personality changes occur well past age 30, but the typical changes are small in magnitude compared to the changes that occur between ages 20.
I didn't write this article, but to me the ages are a little bit over there, a little messed up, no? It's like past the age of 30, but then we have 20 and 40 there. I don't know, I can't figure that one out. Anyway, it is what it is. Bottom line is, the younger we are, the easier it is to change. The older we get, the harder it is to change. It's a reality. They study, not 92 people, 92. They study 92 studies. That's a pretty nice sampling of studies that they study. Here's the point. What I found fascinating about it, I mean, to say like it's hard to change, all right, thank you, I know this. But I love that first, like that very first sentence, that the brain is always trying to automate things and to create habits which imbues feelings of pleasure. In other words, it feels good to be comfortable in a certain pattern. It feels good, there's pleasure there. It's comfortable, it feels good, we feel competent, we feel capable. I know how to do it, this is how I do it, I don't want to change doing it this way. It's totally in my sweet spot, this is what I'm doing. It's so easy and nice, and I love that word pleasure. I mean, Kabbalah, this is now like a little bit off track. Kabbalah speaks about tainug, pleasure, as being the deepest dimension of the soul, higher than the emotions, higher than the intelligence, higher than desire or will, at the core of the soul, the deepest dimension of the soul. In other words, the most sublime label that you can attribute to the soul, above which is just soul, without any labels, the highest label is pleasure. So if the human being, if that which is habitual touches on a pleasure of the soul, the pleasure being, I'm comfortable, I feel competent, I feel successful, I feel like I'm whatever in that area, if that creates like lines of pleasure, like pleasure wiring in the brain, that is going to be very hard to change. It's going to be extremely hard to change. And the more we repeat it, and the older we are, the harder it is to change. So what we're left in an interesting place here. We're left in a place where I would venture to say, and I don't think I'm going out on a limb, that most of us have things about our lives that we want to change, and yet at the same time, it's profoundly difficult to change. because we've been doing it that way for so long. So, and then the question is, the follow-up question is, so should we even bother trying? Like, what's the point? So Judaism gives us a powerful response to this question and provides a unique perspective on the power and the potential of change. So, you know, if there's one thing that Judaism is obsessed with, what would you say it is? Judaism. What's Judaism obsessed with? Don't think. This is like that ink test. Say it again. Say it again.
Learning.
What else? Good. Learning.
Prayer.
Growth. Give me something else. Not a verb. Not a verb. A concept.
Tradition.
Give me a specific concept. Tikkun Olam. Good. What else?
Family.
Good. What else?
Love.
All right. I'll give it to you. Judaism is obsessed, number one, with God. Right? Obviously. God. God is big in Torah. Torah talks about God. But if you look in Torah, the other concept that's mentioned again and again and again, I don't know that you would come up with this naturally, but you'll agree with me, is the Exodus. No matter where you turn in Judaism, there's, in remembrance of the Exodus, Zecher Liyetziat Mitzrayim, remembering the Exodus, right? We, Ten Commandments, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, Exodus reference. You have dozens and dozens of random Exodus references. Don't forget, when you see somebody who is downtrodden, don't forget to give them what they need and feed those that need clothing feed those that are hungry and give clothes to those who need clothing. Why? Because I'm the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt. Huh? Alright, so God hooked us up, we should hook someone else up. Okay, maybe. But the Exodus is again and again and again. We have Passover that remembers the Exodus. Good. What else do we have for the Exodus? We mention it in our prayers in the Shema every single day, twice a day. We mention it after the morning prayers in the six remembrances. The first one is, remember the Exodus. We also have the Kiddush, Friday night, and on the holiday, we talk about, specifically Friday night, Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim, remembrance of the Exodus. So no matter where you look, no matter what we're doing Jewishly, the Exodus seems to take center stage. There's always some. So the question is, and everyone's shouting this question, and if you're not yet, you will be soon. What's the big deal with the Exodus? We're so like Exodus centric. So you could say, well, the Torah is a product of a certain era, and that era, like the big news was the Exodus. Like, that was kind of like what was going on then. It was like the Exodus. It was the latest thing. However, Torah is timeless, and so if the Torah makes a big deal about the Exodus, it must be a timeless experience. So different answers have been given. Dozens of different answers. Amongst them, well, the Exodus is the birth of the Jewish nation, so it has to be very important. Exodus reminds us that God can get involved and does get involved with the world, and the world doesn't just run on its own, etc. There's divine providence and divine interaction and disruption, if you will, divine disruption. So that's an important lesson, a Jewish lesson that we need to learn. But I want to share with you a very simple and elegant answer. And that is that we're obsessed, Judaism, Torah, and Jews are obsessed with the Exodus for a simple reason. Because it's a Jewish thing to constantly endeavor to break out of wherever we are, i.e. the status quo. It's a Jew. The narrative, listen to this, the narrative of the Exodus is not just a narrative that occurred then. Torah teaches us we need to view the Exodus as our own narrative. We need to own the narrative. Own the Exodus narrative, the Torah says. And if you don't remember, so when Kiddush comes around Friday night, you'll remember. And when Ten Commandments are around, and Passover comes around, and every single day, twice a day, and Shema, you'll remember. Bottom line is, the Exodus needs to be your narrative. Your life story has to be Exodus. What does that mean? Every single day. What was good yesterday is not good today. Change, breaking out of limitations, etc. Now we're going to have a few readings on this to elaborate, and then we're going to have a longer discussion about what this means practically and go through various levels. Ezra, and then Jen.
It just strikes me that the Exodus also reinforced our separateness.
Distinction.
Yeah. I mean that we, you know, were a separate nation, or separate, you know, wherever we reside, we're still separate.
We have that uniqueness, 100%. In fact, it's one of the prophets, I forget who says that the Exodus was really when God, the way he describes it, is when God extracted one nation from the bowels of another nation. So it's like, it's when the nation, it's the Leidat Am Yisrael, it's the birth of a distinct nation. Yeah, 100%. Jen?
It just seems kind of counterintuitive that breaking new ground and innovation and change should go hand in hand with tradition, really strong tradition.
Good. So on one level, we're kind of separating maybe the action. The general notion is that what we want to do is remind ourselves that we're always in Egypt. Egypt, Mitzrayim, is related to the way it's explained in Kabbalah and Hasidic philosophy. Mitzrayim comes from the Hebrew word Meitzar, or Tsar, which means constraint, a narrow space. Meitzar. It's a narrow strait. And Yetziat Mitzrayim, the exodus from Mitzrayim, from Egypt, really means breaking out of whatever narrow space you find yourself in. And we're going to talk about what this means in a very practical way. But the concept of growth and progression and not being satisfied with what we've achieved until now, where we are, our habits, our what we're used to, our comfort zones, that concept is at the heart of the Exodus and what it means. Now, you're pointing out that it's ironic or it's interesting to note that we symbolize that Exodus with perhaps the same rote things that we're doing, like reciting the Shema twice a day. It's the same thing, and yet that's supposed to remind us to break out. As we'll see soon, as we develop the class and develop this idea, there's a powerful lesson there as well. Why the tradition evokes the breaking out. The tradition also has to be done in a way that breaks out. We're going to get there in a second. That's a very good question. Yes?
Does matzah have the same shorish?
No. No, matzah comes from the shorish, bland, tasteless, hard bread. Kidding. Chas v'shalom. It's a mitzvah. God forbid, it's a mitzvah. We don't make fun of a mitzvah. It's a beautiful thing.
The name of Mitzvah is from the shorish of a constraint?
Yes. Yes. Mitzvah, yeah. That says Meitzar Mi. Kabbalah speaks extensively about this concept. Take a look at text 4a. Chana, take it away. Text 4a, 220.
In every generation, we must view ourselves as if we truly left Egypt.
This is what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says, we have to view ourselves as if we've left Egypt. Yeah, but I didn't leave Egypt. So make it happen. It's got to be your narrative. It's not their narrative. It's not happened 2,000-3,000 years ago. It's got to happen to you. And not only every generation, every single day, as the Alter Rebbe says. He says, b'chol dar v'dar, and he adds in the words, b'chol yom v'yom. Every single day a person has to see himself as if his narrative, his calling is to leave Egypt. Continue with text 4b, please. This comes from Rabbi Soloveitchik.
Holistic allegorization sees in every historical occurrence a symbol of a more intimate and personal drama in which man is involved, of a great experience that lies at the very root of one's existential awareness. And so the story of the Exodus is related not only to historical events, but to a living reality, as a symbolic narrative of human destiny. In reciting the Haggadah, one is not reminiscing about an ancient past, about people and occurrences enveloped in the mist of millennia, but rather is telling a personal story, pouring out one's heart, confessing something intense, passionate, and crucial that happened to oneself. At this level, one is preoccupied not with his history, but with the living present, not with others, but with oneself and one's own exciting life. A person must see in the story of the Exodus as in a mirror the inward drama of his or her own soul.
As I've said many, many times in these classes and in other classes, there is no ancient Hebrew word in the Lashon Kodesh, in the Holy Tongue, for history. There is no word for history. The modern Hebrew word for history is Historia. Guess what? Sounds like history. They just ripped it off and added a ria at the end. Historia is history. There's no Hebrew word for history. The reason is because history is his story. It ain't mine. Someone else's story, someone else's narrative. Torah says, Zecher, Zechira, remembrance. Remember means that it's part of you. You're living with it. It's part of your current narrative. It's part of your present, not part of someone else's past. Judaism says, the Exodus we're obsessed with, it needs to be seared into your reality today. Today, you need to break out of Egypt. And if you broke out yesterday, fantastic for yesterday, but that doesn't help you today, because today, guess what? You're back in Egypt. Whatever was good yesterday ain't good enough today. Now, what does that mean practically? And why is this so important? So Judaism, so this is the premise. Judaism is obsessed with the excess because we're obsessed with always breaking out of our limitations. Why? As they say in Yiddish, genug schon, enough. This is breaking out constantly. It sounds like, can't sit still. Ever see a rabbi sit still? Doesn't happen. So anyway, so what is the obsession with this constant growth and constant movement? And why is just accepting the status quo so profoundly un-Jewish? So on a simple level, on a very simple level, we can look at this question and offer a very direct answer, and that is, as we saw earlier in the exercise, when we were talking about the things that we want to change in our lives, there are lots of things, or some things, or maybe a few things about ourselves that we'd like to change. And we get complacent, and we get lazy, and we get tired, and we read studies that say, oh, you can't change. Well, the study says I can't change. Forget about it. So what happens is that we'd like to change, and there are things that we know that are, maybe we get angry, maybe we get jealous, and like, our emotional, our character trait, our midot, our character is not where it needs to be. But yeah, we'll worry about it tomorrow. So Judaism says, no. You got to break out of those limitations. You got to break out of the negative habits and the negative dispositions today. You got to make it happen. You got to make that change. Get off the couch and make the change. It's not optional. It's critical to your personal health. It's critical to your story. It's critical to being a Jew. Exodus narrative. Own the Exodus narrative. So Kabbalah teaches, very quickly, I'm going to mention this quickly, Kabbalah teaches that change is really a three-step process. Changing something that's undesired within. Three steps. Step number one is, what do you think step number one is? Huh?
Stop.
That's step two. What's step one?
Decide.
Huh?
No.
Well, I guess you have to decide. Maybe we can add a fourth step. But Chana's got it. We said stop it. Well, what's it? Oh, you got to identify what it is. And that's not always easy. It's not always easy. It's not because it's very easy to justify. You know why I got so angry? That dude pushes my buttons. He knows exactly how to, he or she or it, whatever, always is pushing my buttons and says the things that gets me upset. And they know it's going to get me upset. I can't believe it. How dare they? All right. It's easy to give excuses for the stuff that happens. Again, this is just focusing, let's say, on anger. I guess anger is like one of those big ones. It's powerful, it's juicy. Also, it's good to talk about because you can talk about it in a loud way and it makes sense. So, you know, you got to identify that it's a problem. Once you identify that it's a problem, okay, so now you got step one. Now step two, so Mike's got it. What's step two? I guess there's also deciding that you want to change. All right, fine. That's also in there. But these are my three steps, or Kabbalah's three steps. Step two, stop it. Stop it. You've got the good excuses. You've got the, yeah, it's their fault. It's the other guy's fault. It's someone else's fault. It's the alignment of the moon and the zodiac's fault. Whatever. Let it go. You got to just cold turkey. You just got to stop the negative behavior. Stop the negative behavior. Stop feeding into that negative trait. Now, easier said than done. Totally easier said than done. But that's step one. In the Kabbalah, it's called iskafia. Iskafia, it's Aramaic. Iskafia means just holding yourself back. It's not, you haven't transformed yourself. It's not like you are in a place of spiritual nirvana and bliss and everything is transformed and you don't, but it's, you feel the emotion and you use your, you just hold on, you just grip whatever you can, you count to 20 or you count to 20,000, whatever it is, whatever it takes, and you don't flare up, you don't engage the negative behavior. The third step is, and this is where things get really interesting and transformation really happens, the third step is, and this is a beautiful idea that Kabbalah teaches, is that the objective is not to destroy the negative trait, but to rather to redirect it. This is a very powerful idea. It's like I always ask the same question, because I don't remember the name. It's one of these fighting things. Not Taekwondo, but it's something else where you redirect the person's energy. Do you know? Yes.
Aikido.
So someone's coming at you, right? And you redirect them. Crap, my God, whatever. You redirect them, their energy. You're using their energy again. You're redirecting their energy, etc. So here's the deal. This is what Kabbalah teaches. It's a beautiful thing. God doesn't create anything in vain. Nothing's extra, etc. So if you have a natural proclivity toward some sort of negative trait, it can be, the energy can be transformed, can be redirected into a positive sense. Let me give you some examples. Somebody gets angry. Anger. So redirect it to taking a stand for an injustice, for a cause. You know, use that indignation in a positive and a healthy sense. Maybe you find yourself and you can't be serious for too long. Like, you're too frivolous, etc. Perfect. So lighten someone else's mood that needs to be lightened. If someone's very depressed, etc. So then you use that natural trait of yours in a healthy and a holy fashion. Let's say you're very critical. Super critical. Fantastic. Edit the Shul newsletter. It's a great outlet for that criticism. You want to be critical? Oh, I can't believe that type of that. Fine, mazel tov. Edit the newsletter. It's perfect. It's a match made in heaven. So the idea is, Kabbalah teaches, step one is, you gotta, if you're not transformed, if you haven't redirected the energy, okay, but at least don't engage in that. Don't keep on feeding that negative trait. You gotta cut it. You gotta stop it. Again, easier said than done, but that's at least the concept. The deeper step is hapcha, is where things become transformed, and what you're doing is, again, redirecting the energy. Does it make sense? We're not providing exact steps and techniques, etc., but these are the general concepts. And I love this text. Text number 5, where the Hasidic masters derived lessons from a thief. I love it. Text 5. Burton, we're up to you. 222. In other words, nothing is extraneous to divine service. Everything can be redirected. Sometimes you have to get very creative, but it can be redirected. And here's how one Hasidic master redirected the energy of a thief, at least conceptually, to serving God.
For example, the holy Rabbi Shulam Zusria of Anatoly, of righteous memory, derived from a thief a number of methods for serving God. He works without fanfare. He is willing to take risks. The smallest detail is the greatest importance to him. He labors with great diligence. He works swiftly. He is confident and optimistic. If he does not succeed the first time, he tries again and again.
How great is that list? You got to cut that out. Seriously. Make a photocopy. Cut it out and put it somewhere. It's such a beautiful list. It's such like a daily checklist. Okay, I don't need to... Without fanfare. I love the first one. He doesn't need to be on the front news of front page of newspapers. In fact, he really doesn't want to be on the front page of the newspaper. Because that would mean he got busted. Huh? He's so super humble. Quietly, discreetly. It's amazing. Takes risks. This guy's got everything. The problem is... Imagine if you describe somebody like this, say, wow, a tzaddik, or a thief. No, so which one is it? Depends which direction the energy is flowing. Is it to a thief or is it to serving God? The bottom... Oh, yeah. The point is, as I said, the major point is that sometimes the traits that we think, I can't get over that trait, it's every time I get stuck in that pattern, it brings me down, and I feel like... I'm so frustrated. You know, the difference between that total, like, not only frustration, but almost like giving up hope and transforming it into a holy experience, that line is super thin. It's just about, it's about doing it. It's about number one, it's about stopping the negative. Because if you keep on doing the negative stuff, if you keep on channeling in a negative direction, you're not going to channel in the other. So first you have to stop, and then you can now redirect the flow. Yeah. Oh, I like it. I like it. He buys wholesale and sells retail.
That's right.
Sort of.
I don't know if that works.
Cheaper than wholesale.
That's what I have, where the wholesale people get it from. All right. Next. Good. So here's the point. The point is that Judaism teaches that change is imminently possible and is required. It's the obligation that each and every one of us has. And that's what it means to be an Exodus narrative-centric Jew. Wow. I don't think anyone has ever written that sentence before. An Exodus narrative-centric Jew. I'll take full credit for it. That's what it means to have that Exodus narrative is so central to Judaism. It means that you are constantly working to change and you believe that change is possible, etc. But there's a much deeper understanding of the Jewish call to break the status quo. It's not, and here's where things get really real. It's not just about changing the negative stuff and trying to get to a positive place. It's even when you're in a positive place that change needs to happen. In other words, it's not just that we're looking, the Exodus teaches us to look to break, to change, to transform our negative habits to positive ones, but we must break free of our good nature as well. So if you ask the question, if it's a good nature, why do you have to break free of it? In other words, it's not only when we're messing up we need to change, but even when we're doing fine. We constantly have to strive upward and onward. And this idea is captured, better than I can capture it, it's captured in a beautiful, actually a strange Talmudic dialogue. Take a look at text 6a. Text 6a is on what page? 224. All right, good stuff. 224. Take it away, Sandy. We're up to you.
Bar,
hey, hey. Hey, hey.
Ask to Philip. The verse says, you will discern between the righteous and the wicked, between the one who serves God and the one who does not serve him. Is that not redundant? Is not the righteous person one who serves God and the wicked person one who does not serve him? Hillel replied, both the individuals referenced in this verse, the one who serves and the one who does not serve, are wholly righteous individuals. Nevertheless, one who reviews his studies only 100 times is referred to as one who does not serve God because he cannot be compared to the one who reviews his studies 101 times. Barhehe asks, because the person reviews his studies one time less, he is considered one who does not serve God? Indeed, that is so, Hillel replied. Consider by way of analogy the market prices for donkey drivers. To hire a donkey driver to travel 10 parsa, the cost is 1 zuz, whereas for 11 parsa, the charge is 2 zuz.
So Hillel and Barhehe are having a dialogue about the concept of breaking one's nature even when it's a positive nature. Not breaking one's negative nature, but breaking one's positive nature. Barhehe is asking the question, what does it mean in Malachi, in the verse, when Scripture says that there's a distinction between one who serves God and one who does not serve Him? And Hillel says, both the one who serves and the one who does not serve, both of these are tzaddik and righteous people. What does it mean? What's the difference? It's the difference between studying, reviewing your studies 100 times or reviewing them 101. 100 times, 101 times, such a big difference. Sounds like a lot of times. So he says, yeah, indeed, it's so. Consider the market price for donkey drivers, 10 parsa for 1 zuz, 11 for 2, and that gives the answer. What are we talking about here? What's going on with this budget rented donkey, huh?
Evolve.
But what's with the one more? Why is it so... Okay. Here we go. Ready? Start. 10 parsa. Where are we here?
What is parsa?
Parsa is like, I'm not sure how many miles it is. It's like an ancient... Do we get that line? Yeah, there you go. The line goes, the flag goes 10 parsa, 1 zuz. One more is now 2 zuzim. 2 zuz. What's the distinction? Well, back in the day... Say it again. So here's the thing. If you go here, it's 10. If you start here, so it's not two separate trips. If you start here and go there, one more, it's 11. The reason why is like this. It says back in the day, the donkeys used to go up to 10. That was their limit. Pretty much that was what their comfort zone was. And the drivers, that's what their comfort zone was. You wanted to go 11, we don't go 11, we go 10. You want to go 11, we got to double it. It's not only doubling it, by the way. It's 10 times the price. If you figure out the math, if one parsa is 1 zuz, typically each parsa here was a tenth of a zuz. Correct? You with me on the math? If it's, it's one parsa, if it's 10 parsa, no. Slow it down here. Sorry, no, 1 zuz, right. If it's 1 zuz for 10 parsa, so it's a tenth of a zuz per parsa. And this is 1 zuz per parsa. 10 times the amount. Anyway, here's the point. The point is that if it's out of the comfort zone, it becomes that much more valuable. It becomes equal to everything that was within the comfort zone. It becomes much greater. It's not just one more. It's double. It's 10 times the amount. It's much more valuable. What does that mean for our discussion? What does it mean for the 100 times and 101 times? So I want to share with you an explanation of the Alter Rebbe, who in his work of Tanya has a beautiful explanation. Sandy, please continue text 6b, Tanya chapter 15.
It was standard in that era for scholars to review each lesson 100 times. The Talmud declares the difference between one who reviews 100 and 101 times to the difference in rates at the donkey driver market. While the price for a 10 parsa hire was 1 zuz, an 11 parsa hire cost 2 zuz because it exceeded the standard. The 101st review, which is more than the student's routine, is the equivalent of the previous 100 reviews combined. In fact, it surpasses them, for by its virtue alone, the student is considered one who serves God.
And the question still remains why. It's alluded to in this text, the question is why. Back in the day, remember, this was the era before the Mishnah was recorded, was written. This is before the oral tradition was written. They had to remember the entire body of Torah scholarship outside of the 5 books. They had to remember it where? Right up here. In order to do that, they had to commit the entire body of Jewish law with all of the details to memory. How did they commit? Huh? Everything. The Talmud wasn't written yet. Everything that was later written in the Talmud, they had in their memory. Nowhere. Gornish. Maybe they wrote on their hands. Or cheat sheet action. But they had to commit it to memory. So you now know why they had to study 100 times. You got to review it 100 times to get it seared in your memory like that. So that was the status quo. Comes along a student and says, I'm going to learn 101 times. I don't need to. If you don't need to, why are you doing it? It's not like he needed 101 times to get it. No, also 100 times to get it. Why did he study 101 times? What does it show? What does it show? Huh? Commitment. What else does it show? Sugasan. That's actually along the lines of commitment. It shows that he loves learning Torah. What that means is like this. Certain times we do things because we feel like out of an obligation. Like, okay, this is what I need to do, this is what I have to do, and this is what I'm expected to do, etc. And then there are times that we go above and beyond that which is the norm, the expected norm, because we really care, or because we really want to, because we're really into it. And that extra time is as valuable as all of the other, that extra action, or whatever it is, that extra thing is as valuable, if not more valuable, than all the other stuff combined. I'll give you a simple example. Right? So you're committed to your spouse. You're committed to your spouse to do whatever your spouse wants. Your spouse says, do this, you say yes. You do that, you say yes. I'm committed to put in the time, etc. And then you go above and beyond. Even when it wasn't expected. Even when it wasn't expected and you didn't have to, but you put in an extra effort. You put in extra effort, an extra time, an extra care, an extra devotion. That really says, oh, you love me. The other person gets the sense, you're not just doing it because it's expected. Think about how relationships kind of break down into comfortable patterns. And the comfortable patterns are, I do this for you, you do this for me, and this is how we operate. This is how the familiar pattern works. And it's fine. But all of that is still inside the box. All that is still inside the box. When you go ahead and you do something outside of that box, outside the norm, outside expectation, outside the status quo that you did yesterday, why? Because I really love you. I really love you. I'm going to do something that you're not expecting. I wasn't expecting. I don't usually do it. I'm doing it. Why? Because I love you. Because I care. When you do that, it's as valuable as all the other stuff that you do. And I would say even more valuable. Because the person really gets the message, oh, you really care. You put in extra time, extra care, extra devotion. You do something extra loving, etc. It's something that transforms the experience. So here's the point. If you're doing something positive, there's nothing wrong with that. Judaism says, though, if it's still what you did yesterday and you're not growing, So you're stuck. You're stuck in a little bit of a rut. And the other person may not get the sense that you really care. Maybe you're just doing it today because he did it yesterday. And why did you do it yesterday? Because he did it the day before. But is the emotion in there? Maybe not. If you do it, if you give it the extra effort, the extra time, and the extra time is symbolic of that extra effort, then what that means is it's a message to the other. It's a message to yourself, a message to the other. Yes, I really do care. It transforms the experience. So getting back, I'll take your question in 1 second. So getting back to the concept of studying 100, reviewing 100 times or 101 times, the student that studied 100 times says, yeah, I'm committed to my studies. I'm committed to memorizing the studies. I'm committed to perpetuating Torah scholarship. It's a good thing. We're not saying it's a bad thing. But you're not serving God. You're just doing what's expected. Serving God means you're breaking yourself, means you're doing something that you're really invested in. Of course, if you study 100 times, you're really invested in it. But you're also invested in yourself and your memory, etc. It doesn't evoke, if you're doing what everyone else is doing or what's expected, what you did yesterday, it doesn't bespeak the concept of you really being in love, you really going the extra mile, because you're not going the extra mile, you're just doing the status quo. And that's why the 101st time, Hillel says, that's when you serve God. When you study 101, you didn't have to. You didn't need to. Why are you studying it 101 times? Because you really care about Torah. Why do you care about Torah? Because it's divine wisdom. I really love Torah. I really want to study an extra time. I already know it. I'm going to study it again. One final round. Why a final round? An extra round. Why an extra round? Because I really care. Now you're serving God. As opposed to just serving yourself or serving the status quo. Make sense? Sort of? Yeah.
Your analogy seems as a difficult time to comparison things. Because one shows no difference in an end result. You studied 100 times, you studied 101 times. You haven't created anything different. Where if you're doing something in a material as you described, going beyond, you're creating something that didn't exist before.
Okay, good.
It's demonstrable to everybody else.
So we have to tweak. So if that's the case, so let's tweak the analogy. Let's tweak the parable or the analogy. Where it's not that you're doing something, let's say you're not cooking something, an extra dish or whatever, but you're just putting more time and love into what you're doing. And it's discernible. It's however we can find a comparison between studying that extra time. You're saying studying the extra time is not going to create a difference in your retention. Correct. But it creates a difference in your expression of how dear Torah is to you.
Well, that's an internal
thing, but it's something that's demonstrable in the sense that a person that's watching the person learn can tell when you're just doing it because you're doing it, because that's how you roll. How do we usually study? 100 times? Okay, so the next fellow over does it 100, the one next to him does 100, and I do it 100, and I did it yesterday 100 times. Like, that's how we do it. So it's not like a special thing, it's not like a loving, it doesn't evoke love. Say it again? Exactly, right. So in this case, it's still, I know the example, the specific example is you're still going. Here it was literally going the extra mile, right? I mean, this example is literally the donkeys were going the extra mile. But going the extra mile, so in the case of studying, it's the same, you're reviewing the same thing. But the concept is that I'm declaring, I love Torah, I love Hashem, who's the author of Torah, I'm conscious of the author of Torah. I care about it, that's why I'm studying 101 times, I don't need to. But I know that what I did yesterday is not good enough because I care enough about it, I'm passionate about it, I'm going to study 101 times. And tomorrow maybe I'll study 102 times. How we find an analogy in the human experience in a relationship, I don't know. It would be, I guess, not doing something different, but doing something, putting more time into doing something.
Is that an example?
Putting more love into the same thing.
A husband every night, big deal, takes the dish and puts it in the sink.
Right. Presses the start button in the dishwasher, etc. But again, Burton would say, but that's doing something different as opposed to just repeating it another time. I understand. The bottom line is it evokes. We could find more examples of doing something more. Oh, exactly. It's like, am I going to say the words? Am I going to think about it? I have practical takeaways. I have that as an example. It's the idea of going above and beyond. So that's why Hillel says, you know what? You studied 100 times, fantastic. You got 100% on the test. 100%. 100, fantastic. But you know what? You're not serving God. You're serving the status quo. It's not that the good is therefore bad. It doesn't transform it into a bad experience. Both of them, he says, are righteous. Both the one who serves God and the one who doesn't serve God. They're both righteous. But you're not serving God. Why? Because if you really cared about God, so why wouldn't you want to study 101st time? If it's God's Torah and you're really in love with God, so where's the 101st time? The fact that you're doing because you're only doing what's comfortable to you means that you're still stuck in your own limitations. You're still stuck somehow in your own Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim, yeah. Who?
It just seems like the donkey analogy works better.
Okay.
Because in all of the other examples, the student continues on because they love it. It's not like extra work.
But they, okay, so you could say that they still love themselves loving it, but, okay, so we're going to twist it that it's because I love Torah and it's God's Torah, etc., so that's the angle. I understand what you're saying. So here he's going the extra mile for someone else, etc., so there's more of that dedication and devotion and breaking one's pattern. That, I think that the critical point, though, is that there's a certain status quo, and there's nothing wrong with the status quo, but if it's still the status quo and it's still the usual, still the normal, it's the pattern, then it becomes limitations. It becomes the definition. And if that's the definition, then it needs to be broken. Yetzias Mitzrayim, the concept of Exodus, tells us constantly breaking the boundaries. And it's not just because I want to, I think this is your point, it's not just I want to stretch myself. It's because I'm dedicated to the other. Maybe the 101st time doesn't evoke that, but our next point will. Because our next point is taking it a half a step deeper. Maybe 102nd time. Like a little step deeper. And that is that one of the greatest demonstrations of this positive form of personal exodus is when a person doesn't only go the extra mile or repeat his studies one more time than last time, but it's when somebody does something so that comes so unnaturally to the person that they would have never done it if not for the other, for the cause, etc. In other words, again, if you studied 101 more times, so you could argue, oh, you're breaking your limitations. You can argue, well, maybe that's your limitation. When somebody goes ahead and does something that's so out of their comfort zone, and the only reason that they're doing it is for the other, then you know that they're truly serving God. In other words, they're truly for the other, not for themselves. This example would be when, let's just talk about the husband and the wife in the relationship, where the husband goes ahead and for the wife cooks a dinner, puts together something, even though he's a terrible cook and he hates being in the kitchen. It's totally out of his comfort zone, but he's doing it anyway because, and maybe Raquel, maybe this was your example, he doesn't like doing it. So there's certain things that you do, it's in your comfort zone. There's certain things that are not, I don't do because it's not my comfort zone. You go ahead and do it, that demonstrates your ability to break out, and it's because of the other, it's not for yourself. This is the answer to our story, by the way. You didn't see that coming, did you? Rabbi Hanina, this explains Rabbi Hanina, and the dialogue, and the strange dialogue between Rabbi Hanina and Yossi, his Torah scholarship, the purse of Purim, the afterlife promise, the world to come, and the jealousy of Yossi. This explains everything, without any other piece of information, well, maybe a few more pieces of information, but this basically explains everything. Rabbi Hanina knew that he was a Torah scholar, and he knew that he was teaching Torah publicly, and he knew he was endangering his life. He wasn't not self-aware. He wasn't unaware of reality. And yet he asked the question, Rabbi Yossi, do you think I am going to merit the world to come? So we asked the question, what kind of question is that? We know who you are, you know who you are, what kind of question is that? He was asked, he knew he was going to get a world to come. But there are different levels. And there's one level of the world to come that's like, yeah, you did good stuff, but you were still limited. You were still locked in your comfort zone, so you get like that limited world to come. He was asking, did I really serve God? I know I studied Torah. I know I'm a scholar. I know I teach Torah. But it could be, this is the critical point, it could be that it comes down to one simple point. I love academia. I love philosophy. I love learning. I love intellectual pursuits. And that's my personality. Have I ever really served God? Have I ever done something out of my comfort zone only because it was serving God? Or have I always served God in a way that was right in my comfort zone? So did I really serve God, or did I just do things that felt good for me? If I didn't grow up in this community, in this environment, if I wasn't studying Torah, would I be a philosopher of another sort and just stick with philosophy? The fact that I'm studying Torah and teaching Torah, that's wonderful, it's still a mitzvah. But is it? It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. We're not transforming into a bad thing. But is it so much part of my inborn nature that I can't really take credit for serving God? Do I really merit a place in the world to come on that level of serving God? Good question. This is, by the way, this is not my interpretation. This comes from the great work of Torah Or, again by the Alter Rebbe, the founder of the Chabad Hasidic movement. Text number 8a. Charna, please take it away.
There are two people who are naturally cerebral and gravitate toward intellectual inquiry. Their minds and hearts are constantly drawn to study, and they take immense pleasure in delving into all sorts of wisdom. This was demonstrated by some of the ancient philosophers who were members of the noble class and lacked none of the world's pleasures. Yet they abandoned all material delights and immersed themselves in the study of the sciences. And the delight they took in their studies came far with the bliss that others gain from engaging in sensory pleasures. This phenomenon was unrelated to any theology, but resulted from their inborn nature. Others, however, by nature have no such desire. Even if they are wise and knowledgeable, they take no pleasure in even a moment of abstract.
The Alter Rebbe says that there are certain types of people that love the cerebral, they love the intellectual, they love the philosophical. That's what they love and that's what gives them pleasure. And they can have all the good stuff, the food and the dress, all the stuff around them, and they don't care. They just want that abstract, philosophical, intellectual pleasure. That's what they love. And then there are others that don't love that, that run away from that stuff. And that's fine. Two different types of people. Rabbi Hanina was wondering, am I one of those people of the first of the former category, the first category? Do I just love learning and love studying and I can't stop teaching? The Romans say, don't teach, we're going to kill you, God forbid, I can't stop. Have I ever really served God in my life? He was wondering. Am I really in a real relationship with God? Or only with myself and what I like? This was his powerful question to Rabbi Yossi as Rabbi Yossi is preparing to pass away. Rabbi Yossi asks him the $1 million question. What's his question in the original? Have you performed any worthy deeds? What about all the Torah that he studied? Were any worthy deeds? We know that he studied Torah. But your question is, have you done any... Are you really in a real relationship with God? So he says, have you done anything else? Any worthy deeds other than studying Torah and teaching Torah? So he says, yeah, Purim story. What happened in the Purim story is that I gave of my own money to charity, and then instead of reimbursing myself from the charity money, I gave that also to charity. What that means is he was generous with his money and he didn't pay himself back. The Alter Rebbe continues his explanation. We're skipping text 8b because it's off time. We don't need it. Text 8a will continue into text 8c, where the Alter Rebbe continues to explain this. Listen to this. I'm going to say it outside before we read it inside. You have different dispositions, different emotional qualities. Typically, the philosopher, the intellectual, is one of a more withdrawn and introverted nature. Someone who's more intellectual and philosophical is more withdrawn and introverted and has less of an ability or less of a tendency to be open and giving with their material possessions. When Rabbi Hanina says that I was willing to give my possessions and forsake the money that I spend, my own money, just let it go, more money to tzedakah. When he demonstrated through the story of the mitzvah that he did, that he was of a giving nature, Rabbi Yossi said, aha, so you're of a giving nature. You're more extrovert, you're giving. That does not lend itself in his estimation, or Yossi's own estimation, that did not lend itself to this intense focus on Torah study. And he said, therefore, if you did focus on Torah study, it must be that that was a product of your efforts in breaking your character and going against your own nature, because you have these two opposite natures at play here. This generosity, at the same time, this utter studiousness, they don't typically, at least according to Rabbi Yossi's estimation, I'm not making a judgment whether he was right or wrong, I'm just saying that in his estimation, they didn't go hand in hand. And so therefore he said, the mitzvah that you're telling me of being generous with your money means that your Torah scholarship indeed was a product of effort. This is stated clearly in text 8c. Charna, please continue. Text 8c.
Rabbi Yossi said that the only way to determine Rabbi Amina's natural disposition is by analyzing his deeds. Rabbi Amina responded by relating the story of the firm purse that was switched with the charity purse. This, to Rabbi Yossi, was an indication that Rabbi Amina was naturally generous and liberal with his money. He thus concluded that Rabbi Hanina's devotion to Torah study to the point of self-sacrifice is not a result of natural proclivity towards studiousness, because the studious personality type is associated with frugality.
Continue, one more paragraph.
As soon as Rabbi Yossi understood that Rabbi Hanina's sacrifice for the sake of Torah was entirely due to his devotion to God and not due to his natural predisposition, he exclaimed, "May your portion be my portion."
Now we have the answer to the question. Rabbi Hanina is wondering, have I ever served God a day in my life? Rabbi Yossi says, so no, you tell me. Did you ever do something that's of a different personality trait? And he says, yes, I remember now. I gave this money, etc. Indicates that he was of a more giving, of a generous personality, which according to Rabbi Yossi was not in concert with the studiousness and that the philosophical character trait. And therefore, the fact that he studied Torah and taught Torah to the point of self-sacrifice means that that was because he loved God and he loved Torah, and not for his own nature, but purely because of the cause itself. And therefore, Rabbi Yossi concluded that indeed Rabbi Hanina was considered a servant of God and did merit a huge portion of the world to come. Not that life is about that, but that, and he says, and I wish your portion be my portion. In other words, I'm envious of you and what you've accomplished. This also helps us, and I just want to tie it together. So that answers all five questions that we asked before on this story. This also helps explain the story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Yochanan ben Zakkai was the great scholar who on his deathbed said, I'm coming before the King of Kings, the Eternal King. If I came before a human king, I would be scared and also crying, filled with trepidation. I'm about to face the King of Kings. When I pass on, I shouldn't be afraid. I don't know where they're going to take me. There are two paths. Heaven and the opposite. Paradise and Gehenna. So where am I going to go? I don't know where I'm going to go. Our question was, you don't know where you're going to go. We know where you're going to go. So one answer is, well, along the same lines, he knew that he had accomplished great things, but maybe it was all comfortable for him. Maybe it was all part of his personality. Not that he wouldn't get paradise, but that it was all part of his personality. But the Rebbe said another explanation that gets to an even deeper point. An even deeper point, text number 9. This is an unbelievable idea. Howard, take it away. Text 9, 231.
We are each given a mission to fulfill during the course of our lives. We are also allocated the requisite number of days in which to fulfill this mission. We are given neither one moment too many nor one moment too few. When we fail to utilize a day or a moment in fulfillment of a particular mission, it is not just a missed opportunity, it is an abuse of the mission entrusted to us by God. This is true even if we are engaged in a good endeavor, but one that is not related to our unique mission. Rabbi Yochanan invested every moment of his life into his mission, which was to learn Torah and to observe the mitzvah. So engrossed was he in the engagement and fulfillment of his mission that he had not a moment to spare in which to pause and reflect on his personal spiritual progress. How could he pause to think of a personal development when the moment during which he would pause was designated for the fulfillment of a particular aspect of his mission? Only on his deathbed, when he had just about completed his mission, did he pause to take stock of his personal spiritual life, for as he was taught by his teacher Hillel. If not now, when? The sudden realization that he had no knowledge of his spiritual station in life.
The Rebbe explains that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was so dedicated that he wasn't aware and conscious of his own dedication. He was so dedicated to every moment to doing what God wants. It's like the spouse who not only goes the extra mile for the other spouse, but who doesn't even think I'm going the extra mile for the spouse. It's just always going the extra, always dedicated, but not self-aware. I said before, how could he be so self-unaware? He was self, according to the Rebbe, he was not self-aware. Why wasn't he self-aware? Because he was always living in this selfless state of doing that which was a calling of the hour, calling of the moment, calling of the second, so that he never was able to think, oh, I'm doing... He totally... We're talking about breaking out of limitations. So one limitation is the negative. So we already got rid of that. Then the good limitations are things that are in within your comfort zone. So we got rid of that also. Now it's the limitation of even being self-aware that you're going beyond your limitations. He wasn't even aware that he was going beyond his comfort zone. Not only did he not have a comfort zone, he didn't have an awareness that he didn't have a comfort zone. Does this make sense? So therefore, it was only when he paused to think, to meditate on his life, when he was about to pass away, that he was wondering, so new, did I do everything I needed to do? Imagine being in the moment, being in the zone, and you're helping somebody. You're not even thinking that I'm helping somebody, but you're just locked into that space of help. God forbid a disaster strikes, so a person moves. They ask a person later on, what were you thinking? You know what everyone answers? I wasn't thinking. I was responding. Anyone would have done the same thing given that moment, given that calling. So people always answer. In the moment, you're not watching yourself from the outside thinking, oh, look what I'm doing, etc. You're just in that moment. Rabbi Yochanan lived every moment of his life in that moment. And he never was self-evaluating, oh, look what I'm doing, look what I'm not doing. Came time the end of his life and he was thinking, so new, what have I actually done what I needed to do? He was always doing what he needed to do, but he was always in the moment of doing it and not thinking about doing it. And so we have the final level, and this is a lofty dimension, of exceeding limitations, of shattering all your boundaries, even the boundary of self-awareness and self-consciousness. Make sense? It's kind of lofty. Here's the bottom line point. If we walk away saying, well, you know what, for me, my breaking limitations, i.e. my exodus from Egypt, is going to be the negative habits. I'm going to try to work on some of the negative habits. But that other lofty stuff that was the second half of the class, that was about how to break out of the habit and the road, and even the good stuff is not good enough, and even being aware is not good enough because you're still too aware. That stuff is like way too lofty only for tzaddikim. I want to share with you a simple point that is relevant to all of us. Even we can do both simultaneously. We can try to break out of the negative habits, but also try to break out of the good habits also. What does that mean? Here's very simply what it means. Life is not a scorecard. It's not like there's a checklist and God says, okay, this is what you need to do, this is everything that has to be done, and if not, then forget about it, don't talk to me. There are things that we need to do, of course. But in addition to that, it's not just about the scorecard. It's not just about the checklist and checking things off. It's about the passion and intensity we put into the things that we're doing. This is where what Burton said rings very true. It's when we study Torah. So fine, so maybe we're not studying Torah every opportunity that we should be. We're also doing other things. But let's leave that aside. Because we'll also work on the things that that we can correct from good to positive. We'll also work on that. But within the positive stuff that we are doing, and we're not tzaddik, and we're not perfectly righteous, but in the area that we are doing good stuff, we have to ask ourselves a simple question. Am I passionate about what I'm doing? Or am I locked into the rote, to the habit that's in a sense, tempering the passion, that's keeping the passion locked down? When I study Torah, is it, okay, I'm studying Torah again because I did it yesterday, because I feel obligated, it's a mitzvah, so I'm going to do it? Or am I excited about studying the wisdom of Hashem? When I pray, is it like, oh, okay, the same words and the same pages, I mumble through it because I feel obligated to pray, etc.? Or am I really having a dialogue, having a conversation with God, really connecting? Tefillah is connection. When I do a mitzvah, am I just going through the motions, giving mitzvah, doing the mitzvah, giving tzedakah, putting the coin in the charity box, giving it to somebody that needs, or whatever the mitzvah is, wrapping tefillin, lighting Shabbos candles, or do I care about the mitzvah? The message of tonight is, you can do things in a way that, you could do a mitzvah. A mitzvah, there's no one would say that a mitzvah is a negative. A mitzvah is a holy, positive thing. But you could do a mitzvah and not be serving God, or a mitzvah and you're serving God. And you don't have to be a tzaddik to have this distinction. You could do the mitzvah and be locked into the box. You could be wrapping tefillin and not be aware and not be thinking about what you're doing. You're doing the mitzvah, no one's going to take it away. You got the check on the checklist. But God doesn't only want the checks. God wants Rahmana Liba Boy. God wants the heart. God wants the passion. God wants a relationship. Doesn't want you just to dry the dishes, to wash the dishes. But you be excited about it. To the point that, would I rather you wash the dishes if you're resentful of it? Maybe not. I'm not saying that God doesn't want us to do the mitzvah, by the way. I'm just saying, conceptually, one could argue at least. The point is that when we do a mitzvah, there's hiddur mitzvah, beautification of the mitzvah. Do a mitzvah in a beautiful fashion. Don't just get the most inexpensive. Buy beautiful candlesticks, light your Shabbos candles. Beautiful candlesticks, the tastiest matzah, right? The nicer pair of tefillin, a beautiful sukkah, etc., etc. When you do a mitzvah, when you pray, do these things, these holy things, in a way where you're less locked down in your own limitations. Yetziat Mitzrayim, the exodus from Egypt, means that even when you, and the message that each of us, wherever we are in our spiritual journey, that each of us can immediately take into our lives is whenever we're doing something good, it doesn't matter that we're always doing something good or not, when the next time we're doing something positive, prayer, Torah study, mitzvah, do it with more passion, with more excitement, do it in a more real way. That's what it means to serve God. I apologize that it's 9:35. Why do I apologize? Because I still want to mention one more story, one more curious tale of the Talmud. We'll go through this extremely quickly. This is the conclusion of the course, right here. Text 10a. This is it. Mark, take it away. Dramatic conclusion.
Rava sent Abaya to Mari Bar Amar to deliver Purim gifts on his behalf. Abaya said in this instance, when I left Rava's home, I was already full. When I arrived at Mari Bar Amar's home, they put before me 60 plates with 60 types of cooked foods. I ate 60 pieces, one from each plate. The last dish was pot roast. After consuming it, I wanted to eat the plate. Abaya then said, this illustrates the common proverb, a poor person knows not that he's hungry. Alternatively, it bears out the common saying, there's always room for sweets.
So here we have a strange story. Talk about a curious tale of the Talmud. He's eating a Purim meal. He's full. He goes to someone else's house. 60 dishes, 60 plates. He eats them all. He wants to eat the plate itself. And his conclusion is, if a poor person doesn't know that he's hungry, and there's always room for more even after you're full, you can always have dessert. Fantastic. What does this mean? Begs for explanation. Text 10b, this is the conclusion right here. And this concludes the entire course and sets the stage for what comes next. Continue, Mark.
When I left Rava's home, I was already full. When Abaya left the home of his teacher, Rava, he was sated with Torah knowledge and felt that he was filled to capacity. When I arrived at Mari Bar Amar's home, they put before me 60 plates with 60 types of good foods. The Torah discussion that ensued included concepts from each of the 60 tractates, plates, of the Talmud. I ate 60 pieces, one from each plate. Mari introduced Abaya to a novel concept in each of the 60 tractates. The last dish was pot roast. It so happened that the last tractate they discussed was Pesach, which contains the laws of Passover. They discussed whether the Paschal sacrifice, which the Torah specifies must be roasted on fire, may be prepared as a pot roast. I wanted to eat the plate. Abaya did not want to end the discussion before completing the entire tractate. It was Purim, 30 days before Passover, the appropriate time to begin studying the laws of Passover. This illustrates the common proverb, a poor person knows not that he's hungry. Alternatively, it bears out the common saying, there is always room for sweets. Some people feel sated with Torah knowledge because they lack wisdom and delude themselves into thinking that they know it all. Others feel sated because they are indeed knowledgeable. Nevertheless, due to the Torah's endless depth, it is always possible to uncover more wisdom therein. Some suffer from a combination of both of these mistaken perspectives. These two attitudes are alluded to by the two sayings, a poor person knows not that he's hungry, and there is always room for sweets.
Here's the point. And this is the truth when talking about studying Torah. When we haven't truly yet studied the depth of Torah, we don't know what we're missing. We don't know that we're hungry. But once we get a taste of it, of the true depth of Torah, we can't stop. That's what the Talmud teaches. That's what the story illustrates. So hopefully this course has, in a strong sense, whet your appetite and given you a powerful appreciation of the beauty, brilliance, and depth of Torah and Judaism. So hopefully you can't get enough and you'll commit tonight to continue studying Torah. We have many wonderful opportunities here at the Intown Jewish Academy, dish after dish of delectable Torah delicacies. And remember, even after you have so much wisdom, there's always room for dessert, right? So whether you're just starting, whether you've come to many classes before, it doesn't make a difference. There's always more. So I encourage you to sign up tonight for more learning opportunities, and I look forward to you joining me at the buffet. I want to specifically mention a few opportunities. Number one, in front of you, I mentioned this Sunday at the barbecue. I'm extending it for another day or two. We have an opportunity to sign up for all three JLI courses, 2013 to 2014. You'll see that working titles of the courses are not finalized yet, but those are the working general titles of the course, the respective courses. Typically, the prices for each course is $99. Sometimes we discount it to $89. $180 for all three courses is the offer on the table. And as we did last year, it's for a limited amount of time, for a few days from the barbecue, a few days afterwards. I'll probably announce it Thursday as well, and Thursday afternoon I'm cutting it. If you want it, just fill out your name and leave the form. You can put the form right here on this table. You can leave it on the front table. Just put in your name, and that's it. We don't need any money right now. Just put in your name, and we'll get you in on it. Number two, second announcement, leadership forum, June 9th, this Sunday. The information is there. There's a morning session, an evening session. It's in conjunction with the 19th yard set of Lubavitcher Rebbe, and fantastic talks. We have a great speaker coming in from New York, Rabbi Yossi Paltiel. Free of charge, brunch is served in the morning session, dinner is served in the evening session, followed by Fabrangan. Come to one, come to both. Everyone's invited, and bring your friends as well. Next point, we have a special... I don't have the promo information in front of you, so you'll just have to remember and maybe take down a few notes. Tuesday, July 9th, we are welcoming an expert in the field of ancient Jewish archaeology who will be speaking about secrets of the Temple Mount. Ancient secrets of the Temple Mount, where heaven meets earth. Tuesday, July 9th, one night only, exclusive engagement in Atlanta. Huh?
Tuesday, July 7th.
July.
Oh, July.
July. So next, we're going already a month ahead. We're starting a series on Jewish ethics beginning Tuesday, July 23rd. The National Jewish Retreat in Virginia is happening August 6th through 11th. I will be presenting there as well, so if you want to come and see me standing in a different set in Virginia, we can recreate this experience. Come join me August 6th through 11th in Alexandria, Virginia at the National Jewish Retreat. More information at jretreat.com. We have a course called The Art of Prayer that's starting in August. And we have a soul trip, Monday, August 12th, soul trip New York, one-day trip to New York before the high holidays, where you get a dose of spirituality and also some good shopping and good food right before the high holidays. I will be on that trip as well. Wednesday, August 28th, it's your first flight out in the morning from Atlanta to New York, last flight back in from New York back to Atlanta. It's a whirlwind. Some of you in this room have been there on the trip in the past, so they can be ambassadors, right? You guys were there, right? Oh, just Charna. Oh, and Dave, and David. And Mike's done it, so we have a few ambassadors in the room. Thumbs up?
Oh, yes.
All right, there you go. Sorry for putting you guys in the spot. It's a fantastic trip, one-day trip, and it's all the Chabads around, so you get to meet other people. It's a ton of fun. Walking tours through different communities, lots of food, shopping, some spiritual insights and everything, and spiritual moments as well, etc. So mark that date, Wednesday, August 28th. Plus, of course, in addition to all of these other courses and special presentations, we have the weekly Kabbalah and Coffee class Sunday morning, the weekly Torah Studies class on Wednesday, there's a Talmud class on Sunday morning as well, Tanya class Thursday night, etc. Pirkei Avot, I said, is starting, if you want to mark the date, Tuesday, July 23rd, 6-week course on Jewish ethics, Pirkei Avot. And that's pretty much it. If you want to hang around, if you really insist and you want to hang around for a quick minute and a half, 90-second video about the next course, the next JLI course in the fall on medical dilemmas, then I'm going to be playing that in just a moment. But I want to thank you all for coming out for these last 7 weeks. We took a week off. Thank you for coming out. I hope you enjoyed the course as much as I did. Give yourselves and all of us a round of applause. as a famous queen once said,